Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It was on this date, 75 years ago, that one of the greats in American literature died. Books such as The Great Gatsby and Tender Is the Night cemented the place of F. Scott Fitzgerald in the American literary tradition and helped make a celebrity of Fitzgerald and his wife, Zelda.
The image of Fitzgerald as a roaring 1920s celebrity is one that has stuck with him nearly a century later. But the next decade wasn't nearly as kind to him or to Zelda. The harsh final years of Fitzgerald's life, in which his wife was confined to a mental institution and Scott worked as a Hollywood screenwriter, could have been drawn from fiction.
And for writers Stuart Onan, they have become the stuff of fiction, and his recent biographical novel, West of Sunset. Onan was in Milwaukee back in the spring, and he joined us then. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
What has F. Scott Fitzgerald's importance been to you through your life as a writer?
You know, he always worked. You know, I look at him the way that I look at somebody like a Joyce Carol Oates or an Updike or a Stephen King or a Margaret Atwood, someone who would take on almost every form and just work and work and work. He was tireless.
This is his job.
You know, I mean, from the age of 22 onward, he never had another job. He was always writing for a living, just by his wits, and he had to pay for a lavish lifestyle and had trouble doing it. He was basically in debt from even before Gatsby. In 1924, he's writing to Max Perkins and saying, you know, I need a little advance.
Well, and so talk about the trajectory of Fitzgerald's life, because you know there's a rapid rise and kind of a fairly rapid descent. What is this period? How would you describe this period that you chronicle in this book?
Well, we're seeing him after the crack up, after the worst has happened to him. In 1935 and 36, he's living on his own in North Carolina near the asylum where Zelda's being treated there. And he's drinking a lot and he's not really writing very much. He's hit bottom. He really has hit bottom. But the Fitzgerald that we think of is the Fitzgerald of the 20s. 1920, he is the most famous and highest paid American writer. And by 1929, he's pretty much forgotten and his wife's in the insane asylum. He's dead drunk and broke. And so 6-7 years later, he decides, I've got to somehow come back. I've got to pay off my debts. I've got to take care of my responsibilities. And he decides to make that quest decision to go out to Hollywood and see what he can do. It's the third time that he's gone out to Hollywood here, and this time he says, I got nothing else. I got to make it work.
And this is really nothing particularly new for writers of that time. I mean, Faulkner ends up there, any number.
Dorothy Parker is there. Robert Benchley is there. Ogden Nash, S.J. Perlman. The entire Algonquin Roundtable basically picks up and moves from New York City to the Garden of Allah. And that's where Scott ends up in 1937, the Garden of Allah there in Hollywood, where for the first time in years, he's surrounded by friends and people that know him, people that respect him.
Well, and so this is the other side of the descent. It was not necessarily a rapid rise, though, in his time in Hollywood. It's a time of struggle.
Oh, it's a time of struggle, and he's fighting the whole way there, and he's working. He's working. He gets up early and he works on short stories, and then he goes to MGM where he works on the lot all day long, and then he comes home and he's getting his notes together for The Last Tycoon. But he's working, and that's the important thing. In North Carolina, there's one year where he says, I think I worked on four stories and they were all terrible.
Yeah. What he finds that he finds work, but he doesn't necessarily find home there.
He kind of finds home. I mean, most of his adult life, he didn't really have a home. They were bouncing around Europe. They were bouncing around Minneapolis, St. Paul. Growing up, he grew up mostly, people don't know, in Buffalo, New York. He spent most of his formative years in Buffalo, New York. Only later do they move to St. Paul, which he kind of adopts as a hometown.
He kind of romanticizes it.
And I think St. Paul has also adopted him as sort of a favorite son. But, you know, his roots are back in Maryland. He spent time in Syracuse, you know, and then we go to France and we go to Westport, Connecticut. And then we're on the North Shore of Long Island for the Gatsby years and his friendship with Ring Lardner. And Delaware and, you know, Baltimore. He's just North Carolina. He's bouncing around. In fact, the 3.5 years he spends in Hollywood, for him, that's a lot of time to spend in one place.
Well, and I suspect many of us today look back on that age of Hollywood and imagine it as this kind of glamorous and sophisticated place. But the working Hollywood you portray sounds really no more glamorous than you know, than a factory floor almost, or you know, maybe an ad agency, a white collar factory floor.
Well, compared to the rest of the U.S. and what they were doing during the Depression,
this is true.
It's rather glamorous and high paid, and the people that he's hanging out with, people, you know, Joan Crawford and Frederick March and Hemingway and Dorothy Parker. These are people, you know, sort of at the peaks of their careers. And they're rich and they're famous and celebrated, where he's kind of, you know, he's still kind of broke and he's still working hard. So he's a bit of a character in a false position, as Chekhov would say. You know, he's a fish out of water, you know. And whatever the truth is going to come out of him.
He goes through any number of projects that he works on for a while and he gets kicked off of. And
he's a writer. He's a freelance writer. He's going to take on whatever assignment comes his way and be glad for it. And he does get out of debt. He pays off his agent, Harold Ober, you know, something over $13,000 in the midst of the Depression. He's able to pay for Zelda's hospitalization. He's able to pay for his daughter Scotty's, you know, first the fancy boarding school in Connecticut and then Vassar. There. So he takes care of his obligations, and he was a terrible alcoholic, and he was in the grips of the disease most of his adult life. But when he was sober, he was one of the most courtly and responsible, and he was a sweetheart of a guy, and everyone says this. It's when he began to drink that he became this raging jerk there. And so that is he's always trying to get through that somehow. He was a very highly functioning alcoholic, but from time to time he would break down and his health was breaking down. That was the problem, I think, out in Hollywood. He's trying to work too hard. He falls off the wagon every once in a while. Every time he goes east to visit Zelda, right. He has these crazy vacations with Zelda in which they go off to Myrtle Beach for a week or Virginia Beach for a week or Miami for a week. And this is supposedly going to be good for Zelda. Well, it's terrible for Scott. Now, every time he goes on one of those, he falls off the wagon and he hurts himself. He gets drunk. He gets in fights. It's kind of a mess.
He is really almost a different person when he is back east than when he gets back to Hollywood.
Well, he has these two different lives that he's trying to lead at the same time. And Zelda knows nothing about – supposedly knows nothing about Sheila Graham, the woman that he's fallen in love with out in Hollywood and wants to see some sort of future with. But there can't be a future with her because he's still devoted in a way to Zelda. Yeah, so he's you know, again, he's caught in that false position. So he's a great character to work with because he has all this stuff going on and he's trying his hardest, and then things every once in a while just they sort of explode or implode.
Well, and there's a point late in the book, and I don't think it's giving anything away, in which he's described comparably to Zelda as a hapless purveyor of chaos.
Yeah, yeah. He can't quite understand why he just keeps falling apart this way. And though to us, you know, looking on the outside with a little bit of distance, we say, well, this is exactly why, you know, because, you know, you can't go along that way without doing that. But for him, it's utterly baffling.
He watches UCLA football, I think it is, while he
yes,
is
indeed.
Out in California.
Big football fan.
Well, yeah. And he follows with some admiration the only African-American guy on the team who takes a lot of punishment, and it is not hard to see a metaphor in this guy's experience on the football field.
Well, he was drawn to him because as a high school player, he was an undersized quarterback and took a lot of punishment on the football field there as well. And it's one of his dreams to be this sort of, you know, this athletic hero. And he wrote a lot about, you know, when he was younger, he wrote a lot about athletic heroes and, you know, the scrappy underdog that overcomes there.
Well, and to some degree, I don't know that his writing career made him a scrappy underdog, but certainly at this point of his career in California, he's getting knocked down and having – I mean there's a lot of resilience he has to be able to call on.
Well, that's just the life of a writer. Now, the life of a writer is about rejections, about people saying no. Remember, you know, when he wrote This Side of Paradise, which became his first novel, he first wrote a book called The Romantic Egoist, in which he would give this to Perkins, the editor there at Scribner's, and Perkins would just say no, no, and nobody else here at Scribner's likes it either, you know. And he went back to St. Paul after getting knocked down. He asked Zelda to marry him. Zelda says no, because you're not a success, you know. And he goes back to St. Paul and he goes up in this little attic room and he writes and he writes and he rewrites and rewrites and comes up with the book that became This Side of Paradise, which suddenly becomes this huge bestseller hit for the youth of the nation. It's a wholly new thing. It becomes a celebrity. Zelda marries him and he suddenly, you know, whisked off to superstardom in New York, you know. But he's always going to be that guy up in the attic. He's always going to be the guy that Zelda said no to. He's always going to be the guy that lost his first love, Ginevra King, because he didn't have enough money. He's always going to be the outsider, the kid in Buffalo, you know, whose mom has to, you know, buy stuff on credit down at the corner grocery store. He's always the outsider looking in. And I don't think he ever lost that.
Was it a fine line for you to try to capture the feeling of Fitzgerald in this period and not channel him as a writer?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I knew by choosing the point of view, I knew I couldn't go first person and try to write totally within his voice. For a few letters, yes, but not an entire book. So I'm trying to channel his sensibility a little bit, the way that he sees the world. And I think there are enough clues there in his own writing, which he left us, thank God, thousands and thousands of pages in the novels and certainly the novel The Last Tycoon, the unfinished novel that gave me a lot of clues to how he felt about Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, and he dies tragically at the end. It's not going to come as a surprise to anyone who knows Fitzgerald how this book ends. Do you think, in a strange way, is his end something that he himself might have written?
I don't think so. Well, I mean, he's headed that way in The Last Tycoon. His character Star, the producer, the Hollywood producer, has a bad heart the way that Scott has a bad heart there. But of course, Star is much older there. I would hope not. I think he would choose something more melodramatic. Certainly, the end of The Last Tycoon was supposed to be a plane crash in which Star is killed. And there's a murder for hire in there. There's a murder suicide among lovers, and there's a lot of melodrama in the second half of the book that he never got to write there. And we think of Fitzgerald as the writer of The Great Gatsby. What is Gatsby but a melodrama? Really, I mean, the back half of it has, you know, it's got murder in it, it's got a car crash in it, it's got a wild party. So I think his end was sadly, you know,
maybe like, quieter than he would have written.
Well, I mean, like someone like Keats or like Mozart, you know, he overextended himself. He worked too hard. He didn't take care of himself, and he died far, far too young.
Obviously, you had to have this prior interest in Fitzgerald before you set out on writing this. But were there things about his life that surprised even you as you went to do the research that you needed to do to craft this?
Oh, tons, tons. I mean, the biggest one, I think, was that he may have had an affair with Dorothy Parker in the 1920s. And I'd always sort of – I knew that they'd known each other, but I had no idea that they, you know, had possibly ended up in bed together. And then here they are living side by side at the Garden of Allen. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, here's your ex, you know. And supposedly she carried a torch for him. And I thought, wow, that's great stuff. I got to work with that. Also that Humphrey Bogart was living there at the Garden of Allen at the same time. I had no clue. There, you know, here are these two sort of weird American icons, and Scott's sort of on the downside, and Humphrey Bogart is just now beginning to get some recognition. You know, here they are, you know, all these practicing alcoholics hanging around the Garden of Allah. And just all the people that he bounced around with in Hollywood, because he's there at MGM, which is the big prestigious studio of the time.
He doesn't actually get to park on the lot.
No, he has to walk in like all the other day players. But he's there on the lot when they're shooting The Wizard of Oz. You know, who knew? He's pulling all-nighters with David O. Selznick to work on Gone with the Wind, pulling all-nighters with them. You know, this guy is in terrible, terrible health. Now, again, overextending himself. That he lived on the beach at Malibu. You know, who knew? It's just crazy stuff.
But living on the beach in Malibu may have also been bad for him. You know, the salt air, not so good for his lungs.
Not so good for his lungs, but he kind of loves it out there during the summer. You know, he's out there, you know, amongst, you know, all the rich and famous and their children, you know, sort of on vacation there. Yeah, Fitzgerald in Hollywood. I mean, I knew going into it that he'd been out there and that, you know, I had heard that he'd had a bad time of it though. But the further and further I got into it, you know, he falls in love. Out there. He falls back in love with writing. He's very productive while he's out there churning out hundreds and hundreds of pages. You know, he regained the person that he was at one time. And we forget all of that about him because we're stuck with this iconic view of this tragic guy whose wife goes crazy and then he dies very, very young. And that wasn't him at all.
It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for someone to read this and then go back and start taking the Fitzgerald novels back off of their shelves.
Oh yeah, well it's you know I think that The Last Tycoon especially is wildly underread, and I think Tender as the Night is also a bit underrated. I'd say, you know, we know so much about Gatsby, but go back and read some of the short stories. A Diamond as Big as the Ritz is this wild speculative crazy stuff there, or a wonderful short story like Winter Dreams. You know, he is just a wonderful writer and got to get beyond, you know, that public persona, got to get beyond the fame and just go back to the writing because the writing is so good.
Well, the writing in this book is really good too. Stuart Onan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stuart Onan's biographical novel West of Sunset is based on the later years of writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, who died on this date 75 years ago.
The book will come out in paperback next week. Onan was in Milwaukee earlier this year, and our interview first aired in April.